And the quorum is present, even though I don't believe we'll be taking any votes today. We have been laying a bit of groundwork in terms of our overview of the teacher credentialing process and the rulemaking as well as the licensure yesterday, and I think that lays a foundation for the presentation we're going to hear today that relates to an issue that has been before us for a number of years on alternative licensure. And so we're going to hear from the Teach for America, so you understand the nature and the rationale for the proposal that is going to be coming before us, and we can and fully debate it. There are several others that I think wish to speak to it. We won't be taking up the bill today, but we will on Monday. So I'll give you that advance notice, and we want to welcome Daniel Sellers from Teach for America to the table and for a presentation. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members. Daniel Sellers, Executive Director with Teach for America in the Twin Cities. My understanding is that each of you has a copy of the PowerPoint in front of you, so if you want to follow along, hopefully we won't have any more technical difficulties and we'll be able to get through this. I'll try to keep this relatively short, and of course, if there are questions, I hope you all won't hesitate to ask those questions. You know, it's worth, even for those of you that are somewhat familiar with Teach for America, I think it's worth stating part of the reason that I'm excited to be here is I think much of the information that's out there about Teach for America is often based in what I would claim are some myths and misinformation about what exactly the program is. So I hope today to just clear up some of that misinformation and make sure that the conversations we're having are based in fact and in data. As a way to lay the framework, it's important to understand Teach for America is not just, of course, in Minnesota, but this year we have more than 8,200 teachers in their first and second year in classrooms in 39 regions across the country, impacting more than 500,000 of students every day. It's worth grounding us in the reality of why would Teach for America want to be in a place like Minnesota. And though, of course, we have phenomenal teachers here and phenomenal education systems, we also have one of the highest achievement gaps in the country. The only place with a statistically larger gap, as many of you know, is Washington, D.C. The percentage of black students who are proficient in math and reading hovers below 40%, about 40% points below their white counterparts. And in Minneapolis, we see that discrepancy expand to about 50 percentage points. And so given that and given the reality of where our students are in comparison to their peers across the country, we actually recognize that minority students in Minnesota, and this is the statistic that I share that often gets people to sort of pause, is that whether you're looking at fourth grade students in Minnesota who are black, Hispanic, Asian, or American Indian, in every case, they're lagging behind their counterparts in Alabama, South Carolina, Georgia, in Texas. And as a native Minnesotan and a native Minneapolitan, it's not only shocking to me, but it's also embarrassing to me that minority students in those states are outperforming our students here in Minnesota. Teach for America seeks to attack the achievement gap in a couple different ways. And to understand how we seek to attack it, it's first important to understand that there are lots of different, as you all know, causes to the achievement gap. So whether it's the socioeconomic factors that many of our minority students face, school system factors that aren't allowing them to catch up or excel, or prevailing ideology that maybe this problem is just one that can't be solved, Teach for America attempts to attack the achievement gap and all of its causes. We do this in two distinct ways, and this is important to understand. The first is the part that everybody knows about, which is we actually recruit aggressively to find top-notch teachers to place in classrooms in the short term so that they can have an immediate impact on students. In the long term, though, we believe that our alumni will become part of the movement to eliminate the achievement gap by helping to enact systemic change, and we enlist our nation's future leaders in both the short and long term as we attempt to close the achievement gap. At this point, I want to just quickly go through a few of the critiques that are often leveled against Teach for America because I think there's a lot of misinformation floating out there and our response. The first critique is that Teach for America is an experiment that's negatively affecting teachers and that there's no data to show that our teachers are effective. While there is a rigorous set of data out there, it's probably worth noting that overwhelmingly the evidence says that Teach for America teachers have a positive impact on student achievement. And actually, every rigorous study that's been done has demonstrated that Teach for America teachers positively impact student learning, particularly in low-income communities. And while that data is extensive, I've chosen just four studies to really quickly share with you today. The first and most rigorous was a study that was done by Mathematica in Houston. It showed that core members make more progress in both reading and math than would be typically expected, and the Teach for America teachers produce higher test scores than other teachers in their schools, not just other novice teachers or uncertified teachers, but veteran and certified teachers as well. The next study released in 2006 was done by the Urban Institute. It looked at the effect of high school teachers in North Carolina. It found that high school students taught by a Teach for America core member outperformed their peers, even those taught by instructors fully certified in their subject areas. The results were clear. Students performed better when they had a, quote, less experienced Teach for America teacher at the blackboard. Most recently, just last year, University of North Carolina did a study against their own teacher preparation program. They studied themselves to see how well teachers prepared in their program did against teachers prepared through Teach for America, and they released the results that said at every grade level and subject study, Teach for America core members did as well or better than traditionally prepared University of North Carolina graduates. I share that second bullet, middle school math, because as some of you know, I myself taught in North Carolina and taught middle school math, and my students were actually included in this study. And the fact that middle school math students in Teach for America classrooms received the equivalent of an extra half year of learning is a testament to the incredibly hard work of the students in my classroom. More recently in Tennessee, the State Board of Education just did a study that looked at all 41 preparation programs across the state, and they tried to figure out what's the value add of each preparation program. And through that study, they found that Teach for America teachers had a statistically significant positive difference on student achievement in every evaluated subject and a greater impact on student achievement than other new teachers prepared through other routes in Tennessee. Just those four studies alone, I think, show us that while, yes, for a time, the Teach for America was an experiment, in the last 20 years, we have certainly proven time and again that we have a positive effect on student achievement. Just because they're so regularly cited, it's worth noting that there are two far less rigorous studies that have been done on Teach for America, both of which found less supportive conclusive evidence. But it's worth noting that in both cases, when Education Next, which is a reputable journal on education, did a study about which Teach for America studies are actually good and which aren't, the David Berliner study received a D on that report card, and the Linda Darling-Hammond study, which is most often cited, received a C when they said, how strong was this study, actually? The Darling-Hammond study in particular, because it's so often cited in critique of Teach for America, is interesting because that study never went through a peer review process. Sample sizes appear to be, in some cases, one, two, maybe three core members. And she actually sort of conflated the effect of teacher experience with teacher credentialing. And so it's worth noting that those studies have sort of been roundly panned in academic communities. More qualitative evidence in terms of Teach for America's success is when we ask our principals, do you actually like the fact that you have Teach for America core members in your school? We did a survey of every single one of our principals nationally across the country in 2009. It found that nearly every principal reported core members' training is at least as good as that of other beginning teachers, and most principals actually thought our training was better. Nearly all principals consider Teach for America teachers at least as effective as other beginning teachers with whom they've worked. And in the Twin Cities, whether you look at Dr. Yigza, who's a school leader at Higher Ground Charter School in St. Paul, or Michael Bradley, who's a school at traditional Minneapolis Public School in South Minneapolis, they're overwhelmingly positive about their experience working with Teach for America teachers in the classroom. Very briefly, to look at just two core members, what are our core members doing on the ground? Last year, Ariel Trangle and Patrick Tanis, in just their first year in classrooms in Minneapolis, significantly and dramatically impacted the academic trajectory for their students. Ariel Trangle, who taught at Lighthouse Academy in Minneapolis, entered a classroom where the previous year at her school, 0% of the students had passed the MCA 2 test. 0%. And at the end of just her first year in the classroom, she saw an average growth of almost 2.5 years on a norm reference test and had 40% of her students pass the MCA 2 exam. Patrick Tanis across town at Best Academy in Minneapolis saw an average growth of right around 2 years in just 1 year of instruction in both reading and math on the NWEA, the Northwest Evaluation Association test, in just 1 year of that exam. Second critique of Teach for America is that alternative licensing proposals, quote, weaken the standards for becoming a teacher. I think it's important in thinking about a response to this to try to figure out what you're talking about when you say you want high standards for students. If standards is how much time somebody spends in a college classroom learning about what it might be like to teach one day, Teach for America has lower standards. If standards is about figuring out the best way to actually maximize student achievement, I think Teach for America's program is at least on par with other preparation routes. Whether we're looking at recruiting top college graduates, selecting those folks, or preparing them to teach in the classroom and supporting them during their time in the classroom, every decision we make comes back to a singular question of what's going to drive student achievement in the classroom. And at the end of every year, we measure ourselves against that bar to determine how can we improve selection, training, and support for those teachers to ensure the outcomes for students are even better. I think standards means raising the bar on the front end for who actually gets into a preparation program. We look at over 46,000 applications every year. And those 46,000 applicants go through an incredibly rigorous process where we seek to find teachers that demonstrate the criteria on the right-hand side. And whether it's an initial application review, a phone interview, or a final interview, we hold an incredibly high standard for our teachers at every step along the way as we select the core. And what happens when you actually raise the standards for teachers, as Teach for America is doing, is that out of 46,000 applicants, we accept only 12%. I challenge any of you to find a preparation route other than Teach for America in the state of Minnesota that's accepting only 12% of the people that apply to the program. We have an average GPA of 3.6, an average SAT score of above 1,300. 32% of our core members identify as people of color, far higher, I think, than any other preparation route in the state. 28% themselves identify as being from a low-income background, and 20% are first in the family to ever attend college. The next critique is that alt-prep programs such as Teach for America, quote, demand less of our teachers while we're demanding more of our students. I think this would be laughable if these weren't the types of critiques that are actually leveled against Teach for America teachers. One thing that's important to understand is that core members fulfill the same coursework requirements as traditionally certified teachers, but in fact, Teach for America asks them to go above and beyond what's traditionally expected of teachers. They do an incredible amount of work before they show up to the Teach for America program. During their time in the Teach for America program, they have a significant commitment both to Teach for America, and they're also, while teaching full-time, they're enrolled as full-time students at Hamline Masters of Arts in Teaching program. And in addition to that, Teach for America expects them to give up several Saturdays each year to ensure that they're getting ongoing professional development through the program. We demand an incredible amount of our teachers because we know that that's what it takes to actually ensure that their students are learning. There's often a critique that Teach for America teachers don't have to do student teaching. That's simply false. Teach for America core members are student teachers for 5 weeks in summer school on Chicago's South Side to ensure that they're working with the same demographic of students there as they'll work with here. And Teach for America teachers are required to pass every basic skills and content and pedagogy test before they enter the classroom as a licensed teacher. And so it's important to note that at every step of the way, we expect our core members to actually rise above what's typically expected of teachers to ensure that they're prepared to enter the classroom. Last but not least, the critique is often leveled against Teach for America that our teachers don't stay in education long term. This simply is not true. When you look at a sample size of 20,000 alumnus of a program, those who have gone through the program, 65% still work in education full-time. That number, I think, alone speaks to the fact that our core members stay committed to this movement and stay committed to the field of education. What do those folks do? More than 6,000 of our alumnus are still full-time classroom teachers. Close to 500 are principals and school leaders around the country, and several have founded some of our very best and most successful charter school networks or have led, as many of you know, districts and other school systems around the country. We think that that's an important aspect to Teach for America's program is not only what they're doing in the short term, but the leadership opportunities that they take on in the long term. The last thing I'll say is that when you take a look at what Ariel and Patrick accomplished in their classroom, Supporting a bill like this, a bill that would support Teach for America in the Twin Cities, is supporting Patrick and Ariel and the things that they're doing with their students every day. So I appreciate your time and open to any questions, and I understand that there's going to be some other presenters as well.
Are there any questions? Senator Bonhoeff.
Madam Chair, Daniel, I just want to say thank you for your presentation. I've heard you talk about Teach for America over the years, and I can tell in this presentation that you have gotten lots of criticism over the past few years, and so you've shaped your presentation to address some of that. But I want you to know that we do appreciate having the Corps here. I had the chance to go and speak to your Corps when they were in training this past summer and was so impressed with the quality of students. And they actually came from some of our own districts that had really wanted to stay in Minnesota and were excited to be here. And so I appreciate the work that you've been doing. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bonhoeff. I'll go on record and say thank you for your ongoing support.
Was it Senator Horace Ray? Did you have your hand up, or was Senator Cruz? Sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Seilers, just a quick question. You talk about this 65% retention rate. How does that compare to typical teachers and the turnover rate that they have?
Senator Cruz, it's a good question, and I'll answer it in very quickly in two ways. The first is that we typically actually don't compare ourselves to traditional routes because we actually think that attrition should be counted in a different way. Let me give you a quick example. Shannon Blankenship, who was a Teach for America Corps member in the late 1990s in New York City, taught for 3 years, so he stayed in the classroom beyond his commitment in New York City. He then traveled to the Bay Area, where he founded a KIPP school, which many of you have heard of, Knowledge is Power program, where he taught as a founding teacher for 3 more years. And then he traveled to South Minneapolis, where he helped turn around a struggling charter school and has turned it into one of the top-performing charter schools in the city that's serving low-income students, and that's Hiawatha Leadership Academy. Traditional schools of education and those that criticize Teach for America would count Shannon as an attrition from the education profession because he left his original placement district and classroom. I count that as a system gain. He's taken his knowledge from the classroom and expanded it beyond the four walls of his classroom to ensure that more than just the classrooms and his students are successful. So when we say 65% are still engaged in education, and then trying to compare that to the number who come through traditional schools of education, it's difficult to compare apples to apples because I'm not sure that they survey their participants in the same way. So I'm not trying to dodge the question. I'm just saying one of the things that's difficult is we look at a whole system gain versus a loss because someone has left the particular classroom that they first started out in or the particular district that they first started out in. I will say that we ask our core members to make a 2-year commitment to teach in a low-income school across the country, and 91% of our teachers complete that 2-year commitment. That number is actually higher in terms of retention than traditionally prepared teachers when you account for the types of schools that our teachers teach in. So we're proud to say that our retention numbers are actually higher over the first 2 years than traditionally certified teachers.
Senator Nelson.
Madam Chair, thank you for the insightful presentation. I just have one small question, and it has to do with the testing. The MCAs we're all familiar with, but I'm wondering about the Northwest Evaluation Association testing. I know you've referenced that a couple times, and I'm just not familiar with that. I'm wondering if you could give some background, please.
Yeah. Thank you, Senator, Senator Nelson. Madam Chair, the Northwest Evaluation Association is a test that has become extremely popular, not only in Minnesota but across the country, as a way to reference the performance of your students against their peers and also their growth over time. And so it does two things, and actually both large school districts from Minneapolis to St. Paul to small charter schools and almost every charter school that we work with are using the NWEA because it's become an extremely popular test sort of from the Midwest west of there and in the Pacific Northwest in terms of an ability to benchmark our students against their peers across the country. And so the test both says in terms of percentile, how much did your students grow? So did they start out the year in the 30th percentile and grow to the 60th percentile by the end of the year? But the other thing it does is it also allows you, because it gives you what's called a scale or a RIT score, to determine the average growth that your students made over the course of that school year, so that you can actually say, did they grow 1 year over 1 year's worth of time? Did they grow a year and a half over a year's worth of time, or did they grow 2 years? So it does both of those things, and because of that, it's become extremely popular for school and district leaders to help evaluate the success of their students over the year.
Madam Chair, just a clarification, follow-up, please. So would we? This would be a value-added assessment, then?
Senator Nelson, it's not. Thank you. It's not. I'm not a statistician, so I have a hard time sort of diving into that. I do believe that it demonstrates value add. I also think that there have been some criticisms of the test, and I'm not familiar with what those are. But it has become extremely popular and helps schools determine the added value of their teachers. And I know that schools have used it for that. I can't speak to its efficacy because I'm not that familiar with the test.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Nelson, I think one feature that it has, somebody can correct me if I'm wrong, is a fairly immediate feedback of where students are so that they can determine as they go forward what kind of progress they're making.
Yep, Madam Chair, thanks. The one thing I'll say about it is it's a computer test, so it gives you immediate results. And just like if you're familiar with the GRE, as you answer questions correctly, the questions become progressively more difficult. As you answer questions incorrectly, they become progressively easier, which helps the computer zero in on an actual grade level performance for the students so they can give you questions at that grade level and see whether or not you're successfully able to answer them.
And Mr. Sellers, the GRE is for those who
the
might
graduate requirement examination for grad schools.
Yes.
So,
yep. Are there yet? Senator Wieger.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Sellers. Great presentation. Something's wrong with where we have 32 higher learning institutions now where we can't meet the need and we have to go outside of the current system with the incredible investment we have. I don't expect you to remedy that other than what you're proposing as an alternative route, but it makes me wonder what we can do. Hamlin will provide teaching training for your participants as well as their traditional programs, so I would think there may be changes that they're institutionalizing. But you're aware of the Bush Foundation 10-year program to reform the preparation of teachers.
Yep.
And one thing Peter Hutchinson told us about was they're going to put a guarantee for each graduate that they're going to increase the performance by students. Have you thought of offering something like that as well?
Mr. Sellers.
Madam Chair, Senator Wieger, have I thought about offering a guarantee that our teachers will be successful?
Yes.
Sure. I've thought about it. And as some of you probably know, I've met with Peter Hutchinson. He was actually my superintendent when I was in middle school in Minneapolis, and talked about whether or not it makes sense for Teach for America to participate in that program. And we'd be eager to do so. And so if we were chosen to be a participant in that program, certainly that would come along with it, a guarantee the same that other schools of education are making. I think when your initial point about something being wrong and what is the Bush Foundation doing gets to this slide about focusing on student achievement first and foremost. The way sort of we've always done things is prepare teachers in a certain way and then crossed our fingers and hope that when they got in the classroom they were ready to be successful. And that's sort of gotten us to where we are right now for good and for real. I have to admit, some phenomenal teachers that were prepared through traditional routes. No part of this presentation is meant to knock teachers that were prepared through a traditional route. At the same time, I think what Peter Hutchinson and the Bush Foundation are doing is something that we've been doing for a long time, which is start on the back end and say we are going to ensure that students are learning, and we're going to design everything from the way we recruit teachers to the way that we train teachers to the way that we support teachers to ensure that those teachers are leading their students to academic gains. And then we're going to evaluate ourselves at the end of the year. And we've been doing this for 20 years. The schools in the Bush program are going to start looking at the results of their teachers and how they're doing in the classroom for the first time just a few years from now. For the last 20 years, we've looked at how our students in our classrooms doing, and if they're not doing well, we've gone back to the front end and changed our selection model, changed our training model, and changed our support model to ensure that we are leading to student achievement. So I am eager for our preparation program to be stacked up against any other prep program in the state of Minnesota. People often ask me, have you guys been up for any studies? And my answer is no, because they're relatively expensive, and we have 38 other regions that also would like to be studied. But I would be the first to say, if part of any legislation is a review of the value add of our teachers, I would be eager to have that review and would be excited to see the results as compared to any other prep route.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions?
Madam Chair, I was going to ask a question of research staff. Mr. Sellers cited rigorous studies, and the conclusion was clear that students perform well. And is there any research with a different point of view that our research staff might be aware of, or have you looked into that?
Madam Chair, Senator Rieger, I'm not aware of any other studies other than the ones that Mr. Sellers has cited. I think the rigorousness of a study would include those that are peer-reviewed, which I believe those are the ones he cited.
Thank you.
Mr. Sellers, what in the schools that you've been in Minnesota, have they approached you, or how have they developed? You've been in many, you're in Minneapolis Public Schools and Brooklyn, two school districts, and then a number of charter schools. How did that come about, and how long have you been in those schools in Minnesota?
Yeah. Madam Chair, the partnerships develop out of sort of mutual desire to work together. The first thing to recognize is Teach for America as a program, because we seek to close the achievement gap, specifically target schools where 80% of the students or more qualify for federally reduced lunch or free lunch. So we seek to place in the lowest income schools across the state. That being said, we don't go anywhere where we're not wanted. So Minneapolis Public Schools nearly 4 years ago first approached us about building a partnership, and the genesis for that was that now Superintendent Bernadia Johnson had just arrived as a deputy superintendent. She had been working in Memphis during the time the Teach for America arrived there. And whether you talk to Superintendent Johnson or Commissioner Casilius, who was also in Memphis during that time, or now Superintendent in Boston, Carol Johnson, all of them will say that they are huge advocates of Teach for America, first and foremost, because they were very skeptical when it first showed up in Memphis. And they can tell you when they walked into a classroom of a Teach for America core member in Memphis, there was a palpable difference that they noted. And so Superintendent, then Deputy Superintendent Johnson, encouraged Minneapolis to partner with us. They sought us out and wanted to partner with us. Each of the partnerships that we build, whether it's with Minneapolis, Brooklyn Center, or charter schools in Minneapolis-St. Paul, have sought us out and have said that we would like to hire Teach for America teachers. It's important to note that schools don't get a better deal for hiring Teach for America teachers. They pay the teachers a full salary, full benefits. They actually chip in $2,000 to cover the cost of recruitment and training for these teachers. So in some ways, they're more expensive than another new teacher. And they're eager to partner with us, and we're eager to place teachers in an area where they can have a positive impact. I'm not sure if that answers the question.
Well, thank you, Mr. Zellers. A number of these people, we can ask what did they see when they entered the classroom? Did they ever express that in more specific terms? What is it that stood out to them about what was going on in the classroom?
Madam Chair, I think you just have to ask them. I think one of the things I think our teachers are on a mission. They are on a mission to raise student achievement and close the achievement gap for students who often have not been given a shot and haven't been challenged and haven't been held to high expectations. And this is the first time that a teacher is willing to do that and is willing to say, regardless of all the hurdles that you face in your home life, I, as a teacher, am going to take responsibility for ensuring that you're successful. And the moment that thoughts start creeping into my mind about I shouldn't be responsible for this because of their home life, and I shouldn't be responsible for this because of all the hurdles that they face, we ask our teachers to absolve, to get rid of those doubts and get rid of those questions and take responsibility for the success of their students. And our teachers are up for that challenge. They're eager for their challenge, and they're willing to do whatever it takes.
Thank you for that. I think that's as clearly stated as I've ever heard it. We've often in education and in other fields, stated, and as if we believe it, that people will rise to the level of the expectations. And yet the very categories that you mention, we've kind of used a subtle discrimination and assumed that they somehow can't learn or function. And operating on that belief of high expectations, I think, is absolutely critical. And so I think it's and hopefully it's infectious, that it can move into other classrooms regardless of how their preparation has occurred.
Yeah, and Madam Chair, it's worth noting that our teachers are not the only ones that do that. All great teachers take responsibility for the success of their students, no matter what preparation route they come through. We just expect that every teacher that comes to Teach for America does that, and we ensure that that's the type of responsibility that they're taking. So,
do you have any more school districts or schools within Minnesota that are pursuing having Teach for America as a part of their program?
You know, it's you know, we're in early conversations with several of the first-ring suburbs. You know, it's not a secret which districts have schools that have higher than 80% of their students that would qualify for free or reduced lunch. So with each of those districts, we're having different conversations. There are certainly some schools in outstate, including particularly the Red Lake Reservation, that we are just beginning conversations with as well. As many of you know, right now, Teach for America exists on waivers that we have to apply for every year, which is why we're asking for a foundation through legislation that would allow us to exist here long term. I'm hesitant to expand to places like Red Lake, a community that has too often been ignored or forgotten or left behind, and only to find out that a year or two into that partnership, our waivers aren't renewed. So what we need from the legislature is a solid foundation and a solid yes, you can exist here, and then I'd be eager to look into building those partnerships with some of the other communities that are interested in having us.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank
Senator
you, Madam,
Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. One question I have is we seem to be using poverty as the indicator that you know, those are folks who aren't getting the educational outcomes we should. Have we looked at any data on children from poor households where there's an intact family as opposed to poor households where there's not an intact family to determine, are we really talking poverty here or are we talking breakdown of the family?
Mr. Sellers.
Madam Chair, Senator Thompson, I don't have that data. I will say that, with all due respect, the question itself is one that doesn't really matter to me because it's too easy, I think, for us to make excuses for our kids about why they can't be successful and whether it's because they don't have a family that's intact or whether they don't have the resources at home. Certainly, we can all agree that having parents who are supportive and encouraging could be life-changing for those students and is probably the single most influential ingredient in terms of a student's success. That said, even for students that aren't coming from an intact family, we should expect nothing less of their success. And I worry that a study that says students coming from, you know, single-mother families are less successful starts to reinforce some of the negative ideologies that we have about whether or not these kids can be successful. And I would say regardless of the background, regardless of their poverty status or familial status, we should expect every single student to be successful, and teachers should be the one taking responsibility to ensure that that happens. I would love to – it's not to say that it's not a valid question. It's a totally valid question. I just think for a Teach for America teacher – it's just another piece of the puzzle in terms of figuring out what's going to motivate that kid and help them to be successful. I don't know if that gets to the question.
So, Madam Chairman, I guess the reason it does matter to me is obviously the cause of a student having problems doesn't change whether or not we want to help that student.
Absolutely.
But it certainly changes the focus of where we target our efforts.
Yeah.
And because if it's not a poverty issue, then it may not be a money issue. And that may dramatically impact how we approach it, right?
Yeah. No, Senator Thompson, I didn't mean to in any way invalidate the question. It's a great question. I just think Teach for America is very narrowly focused on our solution. We think the causes of the problem are some of the things that you're actually talking about, and we think the way to solve it is putting responsibility on the teacher to help the students overcome that. So my belief is that the energy and focus should be focused on ensuring that schools are providing a world-class education for their students. So now that I understand where the question is from, I think it's a completely valid question. It's one that's worth looking into, because I think one of the things that we'd find is that for students who have teachers that are holding those expectations, it matters less about what the environment is at home almost as much as it does at school. I think both are incredibly important in terms of determining a kid's success. So I appreciate the question.
Thank you.
Thank you. There are no further questions. Madam Chair, believe there's some others here.
Briefly, Madam Chair, Mr. Sellers, how many TFA teachers in the classroom now in Minnesota? If the legislation passes, how many do you expect there to be within a year or two? And then project that 5 years.
Senator Wieger, it's a timely question because we've just done our five-year projection. So there are 90 teachers right now, 50 who are in the first of a two-year commitment, and 40 who are in the second of a two-year commitment. One thing, of course, that's important to note is for those 40 teachers who are in their second year, this spring they'll complete the full certification requirements at Hamline University and they'll be fully certified. You wouldn't know them in terms of their background from any other traditionally certified teacher, et cetera. And many will choose to stay in the classroom and teach our students as fully certified teachers in the state of Minnesota. We plan to bring in 50 teachers next year again, so the same amount, and then slowly ramp up until, so maybe 60 or 70 in the fall out years, until in 2015 the goal would be to bring in the next five, so by 2015 would be to bring in about 90 new teachers that year, so about double in size. Certainly we do not seek to replace the traditional route to teacher training. Having 180 teachers in the classroom is not going to be taking incredible amounts of jobs from traditionally prepared teachers, et cetera. I understand the Bush Foundation is going to bring in 10,000 teachers in the next 10 years, so our 180 teachers in 2015 will be a small drop in the bucket compared to that.
Thank you.
Senator Harrington.
I'm curious, in terms of one of your notes, it's stated that 32% of your core is people of color. Can you explain, is that number better, worse than other traditional teacher programs or alternative teacher programs? And if it's better, how?
Mr. Sellers.
Madam Chair, Senator Harrington, the number of our teachers who identify as people of color far outpaces other schools of education. I believe the number for other schools of education in Minnesota, and someone would have to check me on this, is something like 2 or 3% of their teachers identify as people of color. The question about other alternative preparation programs, I'm not familiar. I'm more familiar with the numbers in Minnesota. But it also significantly outpaces the number of college graduates who identify as people of color. As you all know, we're facing the same problem on the back end in terms of recruiting these people to come to the program as we are on the front end in terms of trying to put these kids on a path to be successful in college. And so we invest incredible amounts of resources in terms of recruiting people to apply to the program. We don't change the standards at all in terms of the things that we look at for our teachers. The selection criteria and the caliber of person we're looking for doesn't change, but we understand that you need to invest incredible amounts of resources on the front end to recruit enough applicants of color to ensure that you're ending up with a core that is diverse and begins to represent the student population that we're serving, although we recognize we have a significant amount of work to do, and we will continue to invest increasing resources. We encourage people of color the same way that we encourage all of our applicants, which is we market this not as an opportunity to work with kids, though it is, and not necessarily that we're looking for people who love working with kids. What we're looking for is people who are leaders, who have a demonstrated track record of success, and people who are willing to do whatever it takes to help their kids be successful. And we market it as an immediate leadership opportunity right out of college. There are a few positions, not just Teach for America, but there are a few positions with as much responsibility as teaching for people who have just come out of college. And for millennialists who are at the top of their class and have lots of options out there, and for the most part, options that pay a lot more than teaching, Teach for America becomes attractive because we market it as an opportunity for immediate responsibility and leadership in the classroom, and long-term leadership in terms of impacting the achievement gap that particularly for applicants of color hits close to home, because they and their peers are often those that have had to overcome the same hurdles as the students that they're serving. So most of it is in our recruitment efforts. We have 35,000 one-on-one meetings every year convincing people to do Teach for America versus whatever else it was they thought they were going to do. And that is how you effectively close that gap in terms of the applicants of color. A 30-second side story here is I met a few weeks ago with the Federation of Teachers from St. Paul, and they're starting a unique program that I think has a lot of merit, which is called Career Teach, where they're trying to increase the percentage of teachers of color in St. Paul. And I walked them through our recruitment efforts, and besides the sort of jaw on the floor look from across the table, I said, so how many people are you committing to recruiting all these teachers? And they had one person who was going to work part-time to try to recruit these folks. If you want to get top-notch people and convince them to do this versus whatever else they thought they were going to do, you have to look at what the competition does. And whether you look at Goldman Sachs or here locally Target or General Mills, they invest incredible resources in trying to find the very best and brightest to come to their companies. Teach for America does the same thing. And that's what it takes. Millennialists, they want to be wanted. They want to be recruited. They want to feel like they're going to have responsibility and leadership. And that's the same regardless of the color of their skin. And so they're excited to join a program like Teach for America.
Thank you.
Good question. Thank you. I thank you. And I think you may want to stay at the table if there's other questions that are generated by others who are want to testify. Jim Grathwall, I see you here, and you're on the list. Welcome to the Senate Education Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members,
thank
very
you.
Much.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Jim Grathwall. I represent the Minneapolis Public Schools, and so I understand we don't have a bill in front of us that we're not testifying. I saw the introduction, so I'll just limit my comments to the fact that Minneapolis Public Schools has testified in favor of bills authorizing an alternative certification program such as Teach for America in the past, and we have really a long tradition of doing that in Minneapolis schools and in the state of Minnesota. My current superintendent, Bernadia Johnson, is a graduate of the Collaborative Urban Educator Program, another such program. And really, we see the value of these programs very much drafting off Mr. Sellers' comments earlier in the pre-selection and training and placing and supporting of excellent teachers of color, which we think are key for us working with a majority-minority population as students and leaders of tomorrow to see success that looks just like them. So this has been a very effective strategy for us in the past with Collaborative Urban Educator Program. It's been a very effective and positive experience for us with Teach for America. All of our first-year cohort came back. Their survey results with the principals that they worked with have been very strong. You know, we hope to have data in that year-to-year comparative analysis shortly, but it's just been a terrific partnership, and we think it's a key tool for us. And I think it's important to say what it's not. This isn't a threat to traditional teacher prep courses. We're going to continue to support and need our traditional teacher prep courses. It's another alternative. It's another tool in the toolbox. But if and when you enact, and let's say when you enact the legislation that was introduced today or the other day, we're not going to solve the achievement gap. We are going to give school districts interested in strong instruction and strong instruction that looks like the students we serve. You're going to give us another tool. So let's continue to give us those tools and support this kind of program. I'll close there and open to any questions you might have.
Well, Mr. Grathwall, I realize you spend more of your time here than you might observing in what's happening within the specific schools, but maybe I'm underestimating you. Do you see any impact of the work that these and the spirit that they're bringing to that classroom, on, particularly in setting high expectation? Is that having any impact on any of the other programs or of any of the other staff as they work together? Because that attitude is powerful. And regardless of what training it is, if you really don't believe that these kids can learn, you know, that they aren't very bright, I mean, you've set a course of behavior that's pretty subtle. You may not even realize that you're doing it. But, you know, is that catching? is kind of what I'm asking.
Madam Chair and members, I haven't had the privilege of, one, either seeing a TFA cohort member in the classroom. I have spoken with a number of principals, and I wouldn't indict, and I don't think the teachers in the Minneapolis public schools of not thinking that all students can achieve.
I know.
But so I would want to be careful about that. I can report I've recently been in a classroom on, it was a 100 strong who'd care. And really, we should consider whether or not it's wise to let me in a classroom. So that's kind of a judgment call that someone may be flubbed on. But, you know, I got to sit at a table with 8 students. And I just want to say, for those of you who haven't been in a classroom recently, you know, there was the one student who, given the task, was like, you know, call on me. And within, you know, 7 minutes had 17 things to say about the question asked. And there was another student who beautifully, all he could say was, I want to be an artist. And I have no pedagogical skills, but I would say, so what kind of artist? Well, give me some examples. Just suffice it to say, I had no tools to give this student, and a huge diversity of learning styles and types in one little classroom, and you know, my most recent experience. So strongly honor the teaching profession. It's an incredible job, and let's all admit that those of you on this side of the table have done, have raised expectations, and we think that's appropriate and necessary, given that in 2050 we're going to be a majority minority state in Minnesota, even in the state of Minnesota. So we have to raise expectations for what our schools can produce. So have I seen a radical transformation of the teaching corps in Minneapolis because of their association with Teach for America? No. I haven't been in the classroom enough. And I believe we have dedicated teachers in our classrooms doing what I'll call God's work every day. So I think it's because we have a commitment from our leadership and from our bargaining unit and representing all the teachers in Minneapolis that we have this kind of partnership that is, I'm going to say, symbiotic and strengthens the commitment on both partners to do what it takes for the students we serve.
Do you have current data on, you know, any progress being made in terms of closing the achievement gap in your schools?
Madam Chair and members, yes, I do. It's in my bag right back there, and I can email it to the committee. But the brief survey and overview would be for early literacy, because of expanding our 4-year-old program and working with other partners, we can demonstrate we're closing gaps for across all subgroups, and that carries into first grade. And, you know, we don't have an MCA in first grade. Then, so we have our beginning of kindergarten measure. It's very positive and strong gap closing because of our partnerships with early childhood. Mm-hmm. On the MCAs, 3 through 8, 9, and 10, we can demonstrate, like the state of Minnesota, really parallel to the state of Minnesota, slow incremental growth across all measures, reading and math, and reading, writing, and math in 11th grade. On the MCAs, it's like we're talking over 3 years, 1, 2, 3, 1, and 2% growth, just like the state of Minnesota. We're at a lower base. And then on our high school graduation rates, when you look at the NCLB AYP graduation rate, we're increasing graduation rates across all our high schools. It's new members to the committee should, I'll remind you, we have three graduation rate measures, a 4-year graduation rate, a 5-year graduation rate, and the NCLB graduation rate measure. Slightly different, but that's the summary, Madam Chair.
Well, thank you, Mr. Rathwell. I think we're going to be visiting that whole issue and looking at that data as the session progresses, because I think there is a growing sense of urgency about closing the achievement gap and improving student achievement, particularly up through third grade. You know that I'm like a cracked record on the reading area and the work that it's required to, you know, not only the high expectations, but assuring that our teachers do have the tools and the techniques that it takes to to achieve it. So given the variety of learners that we have, regardless of some of these the other conditions that they may be living in. But anyway, we will be revisiting. I really appreciate your coming and sharing today. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Madam Chair.
Is Brian Sweeney? If you haven't seen any. Mr. Sweeney, welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Senators, my name is Brian Sweeney. I am with Charter School Partners, a new nonprofit charter support group here in Minnesota. We are 2 years old. Our mission is threefold. One, to increase the number of high-performing charter schools in Minnesota. Two, to increase the number of at-risk kids being served by these high-performing charter schools in Minnesota. And three, a daunting task to close the achievement gap. We have many initiatives that we are involved in. Just a little as way of background, we are, Charter School Partners is the Walton Family Foundation funding partner here in the state, which means that we have a Minnesota committee that reviews applications for new charter schools, and grants are given up to actually $500,000 for high-achieving startups. And in the last year, this committee has given $800,000 to four charter schools which are opening up this year or this coming year. Another initiative is we are developing a new community of excellence within the charter community. We call it Charter 2.0. We work with 20 charter school partners, as in school partners. They include some of the highest performing charter schools in Minnesota, including many of the ones that you have heard about, Concordia Creative Learning Academy, Hiawatha Leadership Academy, Higher Ground, and Harvest Academy, and BEST. PREP, among almost 20 other schools. One of the initiatives, we have three kind of within the Good to Great Community of Excellence program. We have three separate initiatives targeted to leadership for the school, teacher quality, and data-driven activities. And under teacher quality, we have partnered with Teach for America, and we have incentivized schools to encourage Teach for America core members to go into our charter schools. And I believe the number of TFA core members in charter schools right now, to your question, Madam Chair, earlier, is we have over 50 core members in these schools. So why did we do this? Our partners and leadership team, including Al Fan, many of you have met, Morgan Brown, many of you know from around this building, and Katie Barrett Kramer. Between us, we've probably been to four dozen of these high-performing schools around the country, and almost in six, seven different cities, Chicago, New York, New Orleans, Houston, Denver, etc. In almost every one of these schools, almost every one, between, I would say, 35% and 80% of the teaching staff are TFA core members or TFA alum. We just felt it is something, and kind of our emergence and TFA's coming to town kind of came together, and we sat down and are continuing to work together, and we hope to expand that program in the coming years. As a former development director for the city of St. Paul, I always want to have the opportunity to talk about, this is going to be relevant, relevant projects within St. Paul. And in Senator Harrington's district, we have a nationally renowned, and actually internationally renowned, Montessori training program. It's called the Montessori Training Center of Minnesota. My understanding is that the alternative certification legislation would allow that organization, whose program, if any of you know it, is extremely rigorous and is probably equivalent to a master's degree, 36 credits, and a master's degree in education. The two bills that have passed, or the one house, both of those versions would allow this remarkable training center to have an alternative certification route. So, in short, we're a new group in town. We focused on closing the achievement gap. Our focus is charter schools because we feel that it gives the best opportunity to close the achievement gap. Last summer, the Star Tribune published its Closing the Gap school list, and it had the top 10, including schools that were 85% free and reduced lunch. And seven of those 10 schools were charter schools. And interestingly, the other three were charter-like schools. Again, I think is Dayton Bluff in your district. That was one of the top 10. I was actually on the founding board of Achievement Plus with the Wilder Foundation years ago. And our initial conversation about Dayton's Bluff and the whole Achievement Plus program was that we have to allow these schools to be more independent, and that was the premise of the Achievement Plus program. The other two schools are actually magnet schools in St. Paul. So St. Paul was very well represented in that top 10. So thank you very much. If there's any questions, I'd be glad to take.
Thank you very much, Mr. Sweeney. Are there any questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
You raised a question. You said that your organization is funded by the Walton Foundation. Can I go back? Well, I'm just hitchhiking or using that as a shift back to Teach for America. Not everybody may be familiar with what's the source of your funding. You're investing a great deal in recruiting candidates and the preparation and getting this launched. It's like a gift to public schools. Where is that money coming from?
Yeah. Very quickly, the money that we raise, we have a budget of about $2.3 million this year, goes to recruiting the teachers. That's incredibly expensive when you think about the numbers that I just went over. Training the teachers, actually sending them to Chicago to do their student teaching and give them extensive, rigorous training, and then the ongoing support of teachers. The hallmark of Teach for America is the what we call a program director who's in the classroom actually observing them, critiquing them, giving them feedback, helping them to improve, looking at data. That money is all privately raised, and it's all locally raised. So we have a significant money that comes from foundations, particularly in Minneapolis and St. Paul, corporations, and generous individual givers. The school districts, as I mentioned, themselves and charter schools actually chip in about $2,000 per teacher per year to help cover the cost of Teach for America, and that's an investment that they have to make and they have to decide to make with their discretionary funds because they're interested in having Teach for America teachers.
Thank you. Let's see, who else? But Jim Bartholomew.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman, members. My name is Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership. Appreciate the opportunity to speak with you this afternoon. I'll give you the quick thumbnail sketch. About 3 years ago, our members, as well as the members of the Itasca Project, asked McKinsey and Company to do an analysis, a comparison of Minnesota's educational system to the top-performing systems internationally. We wanted to see how Minnesota's educational system compared, and then to identify 3 to 5 things that the international top-performing systems did that if we focused on those issues in Minnesota over time, that we could create better alignment and improve education for Minnesota students. The good side of McKinsey's report was that we're internationally competitive in our standards and our assessments, and that our funding system, while there's a lot of debate about it internationally, is rather adequate, predictable, and stable. So those were the good things. The four areas that McKinsey, in looking at international comparisons, found that Minnesota could work to improve on. One was the preparation of teachers. The next was recruiting top talent to the teaching profession, better development of school leadership, and better use of data to drive performance. And Daniel mentioned, upon the conclusion of McKinsey's report and recommendations, the business partnership, the Itasca Project, the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and the Bush Foundation formed an umbrella group called the Minnesota's Future Initiative to act on these four areas: teacher quality, school leadership, and better use of data. As Daniel mentioned, the Bush Foundation, as you all know, is working on the improving teacher prep. The other was recruiting top talent to teaching, and many of our members as well supported the establishment of TFA, have supported the alternative licensure legislation here, and Senator Bonhoff and others, as a tool to recruit top talent. Teachers are obviously the most important classroom factor for student achievement. It's also, as Daniel mentioned or alluded to earlier, we're on the cusp demographically of about 25,000 teachers, half of our teaching staff, retiring over the next 10 years. One of the things McKinsey found was about 99% of our current teaching workforce has one avenue into the profession. We don't have a lot of alternatives and options for others to get into the profession. And to the degree that we need to attract as much top talent as we can, legislation that's been discussed before and presumably yet this session is a key ingredient to making sure we can get the best teachers before our kids in every classroom. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Bartholomew? Senator Stump.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the comments that was made, and I think is quite appropriate, is that the ongoing mentorship that Teach for America has, and the kind of constant monitoring and investment that they seem to follow up with once they have that high quality person in the classroom. And we're probably going to be faced with a request for balancing the budget by maybe taking the 2% staff development money that we currently have out there, which we have periodically over the years either set aside, to help local districts get through this financial crisis. Would you see the importance of that staff development, that investment that we call staff development, be important enough not to take that away from our local districts?
Madam Chair, Senator Stump.
Mr. Bartholomew.
The staff development is a critical factor. You could argue 2% is probably not enough. It's a people business, and you need the best people you can, and that includes development. I think the debate has often been, should the state require that of districts and school boards to set that aside? And I think off the top, if we have allowed school boards, if the teachers agree, to forego that requirement and not save it for development. We think staff development is critical, and we'd like to think it's been disturbing that teachers and the boards have been willing to waive the development funds to put it into the general fund for other purposes. Hopefully boards, and certainly the teachers as well, would see the value in development, and there wouldn't need to be a state mandate to dedicate professional development funding. And that is core, is developing your people.
Mr. Bartholomew, just to hitchhike on Senator Stump's, it just doesn't stop districts from making the decision if they really believe that staff development is important. But do we have any, are you aware of, in your digging into data, any evidence of how that's used in relation to the goals that you're seeking to achieve? you improve teacher quality, which of course says staff development. But staff development has got some broad meanings, and we even have it a wide range of options that may be questionable for the use of that in terms of whether they will bring the kind of results that we're aiming for. Have you examined that at all?
Madam Chair, no, in terms of the Minnesota's Future Initiative and what that should look like. You are absolutely right, though, that that is a critical issue. I know in another state that I work that they wrestled with that same thing, because that's the dilemma of trying to leave some of these decisions locally, because they know what they need most, and then relying on them to make the proper decisions.
I think it's another area we'll probably continue to look at. Senator Wieger.
Yes, thank you. Madam Chair, Mr. Bartholomew, or perhaps Mr. Sellers as well, over the past hour, I don't think there's been a mention of the word principal. But the principal's the instructional leader, I believe, of the school, and for that shared goal of highly effective teachers, the presumption you have a highly effective principal. We have the Principal Academy. It gets a few. A lot are turned down. Do we need to look at licensure implications for principals as well as we look at reform next week?
Mr. Bartholomew?
Madam Chair, Senator Wieger, the school leadership was one of that was the third, as teachers and then school leadership is again, absolutely critical. You can have wonderful teachers in a facility, but if you have a poor leader, you're probably going to fail. And there are two statewide school leadership development programs. One is based on NISL that's run out of the U of M, and then there's another out of the Center for School Change that primarily serves charter and alternative school leaders. And we've partnered with both of those programs over the last couple of years to provide mentors for the principal school leader participants, as well as speakers for some of their classes and sessions, as well as facilities. We'll also hope to see if we can't find some ongoing support as well for both of those programs. School leadership is right
there. Madam Chair, a quick follow-up, though. Nothing statutory. There's no licensure issues. It's just voluntary continued.
Actually, I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Senator Wieger, you're right. One of the frustrations, and I don't know if frustration's the right word, but one of the thoughts we've had is we have these school leadership development programs, and in some ways they are remedial to what is required for licensure. And what we would like to look at is what are they doing and what are the key gaps that they're filling that school leaders and principals don't currently have.
Okay.
For the reflection then on modifying licensure requirements.
Good. Well, thank you. I think we're getting close to the end, but we have one more. Mitch Perlstein, I believe, is here. And
she's the leader.
No pun intended, but we'll offer his pearls of wisdom. Welcome to the Senate Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Mitch Perlstein, and I am founder and president of Center of the American Experiment, a conservative and free market think tank in Minneapolis, which has just celebrated its 20th anniversary. My previous life included time in President C. Peter McGraw's office at the University of Minnesota and in the research arm of the United States Department of Education, where I had a modest involvement with teacher certification, alternative teacher certification. My doctorate is in educational administration, also from Minnesota, and topping it all, I am very appreciative for this moment. Perhaps the most useful contribution I can make in these few moments is to draw a link between the subject at hand and a book I'm writing that connects five dots that have never been adequately connected before. Family breakdown, how that leads to educational weakness, how that leads to economic weakness, how that in turn leads to a loss of personal and national economic competitiveness, and how all that inescapably is leading to deepening class divisions in a country which has never liked thinking of itself as demarcated in such ways. Americans also don't like thinking of their country as having just about the highest family fragmentation rates in the world, but I'm afraid we do, which begs the question, what is likely the most effective type or types of education for boys and girls growing up in single-parent homes, many of whom have been described as suffering father wounds? Obviously, this is a very sensitive matter, so before going on, let me quickly note a couple of essential caveats. I am not beating up on single mothers, of whom my wife was one for a long time before we met. Stuff happens, as the saying goes. I'm also fast to note that millions of kids growing up in single-parent homes are doing just great, just as millions of kids growing up in two-parent families are not. But on decided average, the research is clear that high rates of family breakdown in Minnesota and the nation depress educational performance. Back to the kinds of programs which might work best. I am more than impressed with the kinds of schools profiled in a book published a little more than a year ago with the telling title, Sweating the Small Stuff, Inner City Schools and the New Paternalism by journalist David Whitman. Think, for example, of places such as KIPP schools, shorthand for Knowledge is Power program. Pick your descriptor. These are extra demanding and tough-loving institutions where boys and girls from tough neighborhoods often do very well, stunningly well in some instances, even when compared to kids growing up in much luckier circumstances. Getting to the nub, what's the connection between many of these excellent schools and alternative teacher certification? David Whitman writes of how teachers in the schools he examines, which are mostly charter schools, are obliged, among other things, to have deep personal commitments to closing achievement gaps, working extended days, and being available to students whenever needed. It is therefore no coincidence, he adds, how, and this is a quote, most teachers in the new paternalistic schools are young, idealistic, and relatively inexperienced. Keeping very much in mind how kids in these schools are being very well taught and served, I would further add how many of their teachers have not been conventionally certified, and how many, in fact, have come to the profession not via traditional colleges of education, but by way of some of the best liberal arts colleges in the world, and by no means, incidentally, Teach for America. I would take this salute and assurance one step further. Not only are vital numbers of alternatively certified young men and women doing great jobs in classrooms, but a key number of them over the last few decades have also conceived, started, and led some of the most important new schools themselves. I'm thinking here, for example, of David Levin and Michael Feinberg of KIPP. I'm also thinking of other reformers such as Michelle Rhee, who arguably has done more to improve public education in Washington, D.C. than anyone else in many years. Ladies and gentlemen, Minnesota, unfortunately, has not been a leader in alternative teacher certification. But presuming that any expansion of such programs draws wisely on the successes of other states, policymakers and parents have nothing to worry about when it comes to educational quality. Wholly the opposite is the case. More specifically, as long as they're soundly conceived and operated, programs aimed at making it feasible for non-education majors and mid-career professionals to become teachers work exceedingly well. Or if I were to frame matters in terms of the book, I'm more than preoccupied now. This is my book, not Whitman's, I should say. Children who are in need of the most might well benefit the most by opening up teaching ranks to men and women invaluably rich in talent and commitment. Men and women, moreover, who just might prove to be our state and nation's most important educational innovators and builders in the decades going forward. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mitch. Any questions? Pretty profound statement, as I usually hear from you.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you very much. Chairman. Mr. Sellers, do you have anything that you want to add as we close this?
No, thanks for engaging in a lively discussion. I am open to meeting with any of you at any time. So please don't hesitate to seek me out if you have questions or other thoughts about our approaches. So thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you very much, and thank you, members, for your attention. I think this is an important topic, and Monday we will be having bills before us. So look forward to seeing you at 3 o'clock on Monday.
Thank you all.
Thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned.